Welcome to another edition of Blue Republican Radio. This is Robin Kerner, the original Blue Republican, not broadcasting this time from my dining room table in Seattle, but from a lovely autumnal day in Central Europe. If you listen to my recent show, you know that I came a couple of weeks ago to Central Europe. I've been in Slovenia and the Czech Republic, spreading liberty, teaching liberty, and as always, I've had a great time. If you're interested in what I've been up to, I'm with the Language of Liberty Institute, and I actually did an interview months ago when I started Blue Republican Radio with the executive director of the Language of Liberty Institute, under whose auspices I do this work around the world. And I should probably, before I begin, apologize for the sound quality. Now, when I'm doing this at home, I have my highfalutin, high-tech, professional sound equipment, the mixer and the professional mic and all of that. But I'm doing this on one of these cheap Charlie stick-on-your-head mics, and it only has mono sound and not stereo and all that kind of thing. So thank you for bearing with me today for this show. Now, let's see, I'm recording this on the 8th of October. You're going to be listening to this if you're listening to the first stream on the 11th of October. And in the time in between, on the 9th specifically, something very interesting will have happened in England. UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, who any of my followers, any of my, you know, readers and listeners to this show will know about, they will have won their first seat in the British Parliament. Now, I've just blogged about how they did that. There's a great article in The Guardian that was written by, a leftist. And The Guardian is a leftist newspaper, British leftist newspaper. But he wrote a smashing article on the importance of what is happening in Britain and the massive defections from all over the political spectrum to UKIP. Now, obviously, with the seat, the parliamentary seat that I am guessing UKIP will have by the time this show airs, they have a much bigger platform to do even more damage to the establishment. But the article in question, and go to bluerepublican.org, check the blog and look for this article where I link it. It points out, you know, that politics just isn't very logical. You know, it's not much about rational argument. UKIP seems to be picking up the disaffected, poor, working class, traditional Labour voters, traditional lefty voters, even though the media insist that UKIP are more right-wing populists, certainly more libertarian populists, more heirs to Thatcher. So this is very interesting. Politically, a lot of the appeal of UKIP should be to the right, but they're pulling a lot of people who are traditional left-wing working-class voters, because political appeal is often about culture. And there's a cultural identification between UKIP, United Kingdom Independence Party, and some of these poor, disaffected, disillusioned, disenfranchised almost British voters who feel that they want any credible anti-establishment representation, and UKIP is that. I know there are lessons there for the liberty movement in the US, and you know, I write a lot about what those lessons are, but hopefully, as I say, by the time this airs, we will have seen something very exciting happen in Britain. You know, and hopefully it bodes well for the liberty movements, more broadly, especially in the United States. So yeah, so I first was in Slovenia, and I was actually giving a class about political communication to a very interesting audience. The camp was, as is usually the case, young adults, but kind of at the end of the camp, we had a different audience of professionals, like older professionals, mature professionals, including former ministers of the Slovenian government, journalists, activists, people who run NGOs, and it was really fantastic to be able to talk to them about political communication. I sometimes call it the art of political persuasion, a rather thankless art. I've written about that too. But I do love giving this lecture. And I think it was very well received. You know, these principles, what works, obviously there are differences among cultures, right? The way to make a connection with one culture may not be the same as the way to make a connection with another, but human nature is kind of the same everywhere to a very large extent. And the way people form their views, the way people are persuaded, just, you know, even on the at the level of neurology, that doesn't change much among cultures. So it was very interesting to be able to give my classes on political communication in these different cultures. I gave it, I was in Sacramento just a few weeks ago giving it to the Libertarian Party over there in Sacramento, and then in Slovenia, and I gave it again to young activists in the Czech Republic. That was the second camp that I have been doing, and it's very interesting because one comment that I got following that was that it was very inspiring. A lot of students said it was a very inspiring lecture, which was kind of very gratifying. I guess it is inspiring to be given tools to do something that you're passionate about doing. So anyway, you can see why I love doing these camps. What else did I speak about the last couple of weeks? I have spoken... I was asked to do an introduction to classical liberalism, but it became clear that the audience were already way too advanced for an introduction to classical liberalism. They all knew who Hayek was and what he stood for, and Bastiat and what he stood for, and I'm sure, indeed, many of them have even read more of the Liberty Canon than I have. So I kind of tweaked it a bit. Instead of doing an introduction to classical liberalism, I did more of an introduction to the development of classical liberal politics. How has it actually been that the ideas of classical liberalism have been manifest in politics, in legislation, over the years? And as my listeners know, and I'm very excited about this, this really is, 2014 really is the 1,000th anniversary, exactly one millennium, of constitutional liberty, or you might say, liberal constitution, because it was in 1014 that the first document in the Anglo tradition was signed by a king to limit his power. And you can, you know, I've written about that, I've spoken about that on this show. So, you know, it's very interesting to trace, especially for activists, especially for those of us who really want to make a difference in the culture and then in politics, and it always is that way, it's culture first and then politics, how that has actually succeeded in history. You know, because just putting out the theory, the great ideas of liberty, it's very important, but it's not usually what gets the job done. So I kind of done a bit of historical tracing of that. That was one of the lectures. That was actually my first lecture in the Czech Republic. And then another one I had the pleasure of giving, and I do love giving this, was on the modern monetary system. And I do something that for libertarians is a little controversial. I draw quite a bit on modern monetary theory. Now, if you don't know what modern monetary theory is, and you're an Austrian, in Austria, you're into Austrian economics, don't be scared of it. You need to take a look at it. It turns out that a lot of Austrian economists don't like modern monetary theory because a lot of its adherents or proponents, or you might even say developers, are definitely progressive. Modern monetary theory talks about, in a fiat monopoly money system, what actually are the dynamics of money. And Austrians don't like it because in a fiat monopoly monetary system, the government is completely unbounded. It can do anything it wants, it can create money to do anything it wants, and of course the modern monetary fiat system is completely at odds with limited and constitutional government. So we may not like it, but precisely because we don't like it, precisely because it is so dangerous, we need to understand it. And a lot of the modern monetary theorists have really developed a deep understanding of how it is that government creates money by spending money. And why is it that if the government can create money, which it can and it does by spending, why is it that we have taxation? The government doesn't need to tax to raise revenue to spend because it prints money into existence when it spends it. And you can also ask, well, why would the government borrow money if it doesn't need to borrow it? Because it is the issuer of money. Now, obviously, it's the issuer of money through the central bank, And, you know, there are certain mechanics to that, but ultimately it has never been the case that the central bank has said to the Treasury, we're not going to clear that welfare check because we're independent of you and we don't think your credit is good anymore. Central bank independence is somewhat nominal when it comes to this. So anyway, I give a lecture about that, and I love giving that lecture because I see the wheels turning in the heads of the audience, and then I always get these kind of fascinated and sometimes kind of surprised questions, and it's very exciting. I kind of think it's the modern monetary system is a bit like quantum mechanics. Richard Feynman famously said, if you think you understand quantum mechanics, then you don't understand quantum mechanics. Well, you know what, if you think you understand the modern monetary system in its detail, then you probably don't understand the modern monetary system, because it's more terrifying than you can even imagine, than even Austrians can imagine, I would say. So anyway, that's what I've been up to, and it's been marvellous. And by the time you listen to this, I will be in England seeing my family. And after the weeks and months that I've spent with Dan Latrimurti, who I interviewed a couple of weeks ago, on the development of the newbluerepublican.org, which has taken hundreds of hours of his time and mine, I think I've deserved something of a vacation. So I'm looking forward to spending that with my dad and my mum and other miscellaneous relatives. So, let me just give you some of my impressions of Slovenia and the Czech Republic. I'd never been to Slovenia before, but I got to say, even, you know, in the drive from the airport to the lake where the camp was being held, the Liberty camp was being held, I was stunned by the condition of the homes and the size of the homes. A lot of people commented when I kind of arrived, and have commented to me since in talking about my impressions of Slovenia. They say, it looks like Switzerland, doesn't it? And it kind of does. It's an absolutely beautiful country, at least the bit of it that I saw. And it's just surprising, because the quality of the homes is high, but the median income is only about 400 euros a month, which is kind of similar to the median income in a country like Slovakia, for example. But the fabric of the nation, the quality of the fabric of the nation, seems so much higher in Slovenia. And, you know, this kind of begs a question. Why? And I asked a couple of people. Certainly, you know, Slovenia was part of Yugoslavia, where they had a, dare I say, a more benign form of communism, perhaps, under Tito than prevailed in Czech Republic and Slovakia and whatever, where the fabric of the nation seems to be not of such high quality, even though the GDP per head is now similar. But, of course, it's not really just about the economics. It's about the culture. And before the communists were in Slovenia, the Slovenians prioritized the quality of their homes and the size of their homes and making them look beautiful, and that's where they decided to spend their money, and that's something that is in Slovenian culture very important. And this speaks to something else that I always find fascinating, which is that, you know, again, as Liberty folk, we spend a lot of time talking and thinking about the principles of economics and certainly politics that make for peace and prosperity. But there's another piece. There is the culture. You know, what are the prevailing attitudes in the nation that determine how eager people are to have prosperity and what it is they want to do with it when they get it? So Slovenia was kind of like, discovering that it looks so much like Switzerland was a big eye-opener. It actually reminded me of my impressions in when I was in Brazil last year, also doing a Liberty camp. You know, everybody talks about the BRIC countries, and the BRICs are coming, right? You know, this is where the big growth is, this is where to place your bets. Well, I was in Porto Alegre in the south of Brazil, where this boom was supposedly happening. And, you know, it was just interesting. Beautiful buildings in that town, and built by the Portuguese, of course, when they were there. but not only are they being left to rot, are they en masse, are they falling down? Well, certainly maybe not falling down, but you know, they're kind of the external walls are crumbling and looking grotty. They're also graffitied. Everywhere is graffiti, and you know, it just struck me that if a culture doesn't care very much about the quality of its material environment, perhaps that's going to have as much of an impact on its prosperity and its entrepreneurism, etc., as economic freedom. Anyway, it's just a thought. So, since I've spent a lovely couple of weeks in former communist nations, and specifically in the Czech Republic that was annexed by the Soviet Union, and because I am travelling and don't have a lot of time and certainly haven't wanted to set up interviews whilst I've been on the road and teaching, which has been quite intense, I'm going to cheat a little bit this week. I'm using my presence in the former Soviet republics as an excuse to run again a edited down version of my interview with Jeffrey Tucker. I've interviewed him twice. My first interview with him was entitled Against Libertarian Brutalism. Brutalism being an architectural style that was kind of pioneered in socialist countries, and especially the Soviet socialist countries. And you know, it also speaks to the interview speaks deeply to my messages of political communication. So I think for more than one reason, it's very appropriate that I play it for you again this week.